Tonight, as I sent out in an email, hopefully everybody read, I just came early today, and if everybody was here, we were going to try it. So if anybody doesn't have any real good reason not to, we'll probably start first session beginning at 10:40, which is 5 minutes earlier, go to about 9:40, I'm sorry, 9:40. Yeah, 10:40 is better for me. I am not a morning person. Neither is Rena, though, so I think I'm bad. So we'll go to 10:35 then, take a break till about 10:50, and that way we'll get close to an hour for each class. It won't be quite an hour, but then that way when they start pouring out at 10:45, we'll be done. So if that's okay with everybody, anybody have any questions, or is everybody fine with it, then we'll start that next Sunday, and I will make a change on the website so our hours are posted correctly. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's go on here. Dealing with these sins of the tongue, another form of lying is equivocation. Point two here, equivocation is the act of using equivocal language with the intention of deceiving another. Equivocal language refers to the types of words that are liable to be misunderstood, or words that have two or more meanings in the first place. So, every feather is light. Well, that can mean two different things depending upon how you interpret the word light, because they have different meanings. So to equivocate is to use ambiguous language, which allows for more than one interpretation. Does it refer to the weight or the color of the feather? Another related idea is that of misrepresentation, only relating certain facts and omitting others in order to give a less than honest report. This is often done in order to provide a more favorable impression or to hide any appearance of wrongdoing. And perjury, this is a specialized of lying. It's a special class that of lying that refers to lying on the witness stand. Lying in a legal setting. This is the type of lying that's done there. Zechariah. Zechariah 8:17. And let none of you devise evil in your heart against another. And do not love perjury, for all these are what I hate, declares the Lord. Paul lists it in 1 Timothy 1:10 as one of the bona fide understandings of the Mosaic law, that he begins his idea in verse 8. We know that the law is good. But we have these people who want to be teachers. They're teacher wannabes. They're all over the internet. They're not really trained in sound doctrine. They just pass themselves off as being trained. So they throw up a Greek word here or there, or they make assertions that they can't prove. And most of them are simply just wannabe fundies, really, is all they are. And they want to be teachers of the law here, even though they do not understand what they're saying or the matters about which they make confident assertions. We know that the law is good. Again, the Mosaic law is in view, but one has to use it legally or lawfully for its own purposes. And then in verse 1:10, he talks about the law is not made, or verse 9 rather, for a righteous person. The law-abiding citizen doesn't need laws. He's okay. He's not going to kill his neighbor or rape or steal or any of these other things. He's a righteous person. He wants to do God's will. But the law is made for those who are lawless and rebellious, for ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and the profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for immoral men and homosexuals, and kidnappers and liars and perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. And while they are opponents wouldn't want to admit this, being a homosexual and a kidnapper and a perjurer and a liar is all just as bad as murder. They're all unlawful. And they're morally wrong, no matter what anybody says or how much they try to pass this off. All right, flattery, second major one here, Roman numeral 4, vocabulary, Hebrew vocabulary. Here, the kalak adjective, literally to be smooth or slippery. It's seen in that way in Genesis 27:11. It is used in a figurative sense. I mean, if you, you know what smooth and slippery is. Here it comes to have the idea of smooth and slippery speech, of smooth or flattering speech, 27:11. And Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, saying, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man." Apparently, it was noticeable difference in body hair on these two guys. Jacob couldn't pass himself off as Esau. So they got around that thanks to Rebekah. There are a number of terms derived from this verb, the verb kalak. I didn't have it in there. And all of them have the idea of being smooth or slippery, which is, again, applied figuratively to the words or speech. Greek vocabulary, krestologia, a noun, one times means smooth, plausible, deceptive speech. A related noun refers to a bad person who would make fine and believable speeches. In Romans 16:18, these are the people, I believe, that Paul warns against. The people who come, as he says, who promote dissensions. Number one, they want to fight, they want to argue, they've got a problem, and they want you to have a problem with them. And hindrances contrary to the teaching you have learned, and turn away from them. It appears that they are to be on the lookout for these, that these weren't necessarily a big part of the Roman problem at that time. Paul does the same thing here coming up in Philippians 3, where he tells them three times, look out, look out, look out. That apparently the enemies had not made inroads in Philippi or in Rome here, but that believers would be alert to them when they showed up. For such men, he says, are slaves, not of our Lord Jesus Christ, but of their own appetites. The word is belly, and it really probably has the idea of their own emotions, their own inner thoughts and all of that. But by their smooth and flattering speech, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting. So when people come at you, and you're just great, and you can do no wrong, I've met you. There's nobody here like that. I'm not like that. When people start flattering you, beware. Because very often it is a cover for something else. A more sinister motive at times. The second one here, eulogia, 16 times, the act of speaking in favorable terms. Praise, eulogy. Our word eulogy comes from this. It is used in Romans of words that are well chosen but untrue. Falsely eloquent or flattering. And that's that same verse. Their smooth speech and their flattering speech. And literally, Christologia, that just actually means good words. Eulogia has a similar meaning. Means good words. Kalakia here, noun, one time, exaggerated praise. Fawning speech or flattering. Well, flattery is defined as appealing to the self-love or vanity of someone by means of skillful, crafty commendations or unwarranted praise. What is being said is not necessarily or actually true, but comes from a mental attitude of deceit that is designed to mislead the object of flattery. This is done quite often in order to gain some advantage for the flatterer. This isn't, again, something people do just to do it. They're doing it in many cases to advance themselves or to cover something up, or more likely to advance themselves. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Certain people, you can't count on their word because they just no good for it. And this is not what believers are supposed to be. Our yes is supposed to be yes. Our no is supposed to be no. We are not to be engaged in hidden agendas, behind the scenes activity, trying to fool people. That's not why we're here. And then the believers that do that, very often, if they're in a sound church, they're going to be exposed by the lifestyle of other believers who will not lay hands on these pursuits that are not a part of the godliness code. Their inward tongue, their inward part is destruction itself. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. Hold them guilty, O God. And also here, Jude, next to last book there, the New Testament, Jude 1:16. These are grumblers, finding fault. I've met people like this. I've met some people, they've sat under 3, 4, 5 different pastors. None of them ever pleased them. Maybe there's a link there. Maybe it isn't the 5, 6, 7 pastors they've sat under. Maybe they've got some problems that need to be addressed. And this is one of the things we have to watch out. We're going to get this idea of murmuring and grumbling. We just saw it, in fact. Finding fault, following after their own lusts. They have their own hidden agenda. They just don't, I'm going to tell you. They speak arrogantly, flattering people for the sake of gaining an advantage. And don't fall for these types of people. So, when it comes from a deceitful mental attitude, it is commonly associated with that, which is false or deceitful. Psalm 12:2. But again, flattery is often designed to cover up. Here, what he calls the double heart. We could read this, and this could become our motto. Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases to be. For the faithful disappear from among the sons of men. They speak falsehood to one another. With flattering lips and with a double heart they speak. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips. The tongue that speaks great things. Who have said, with our tongue we will prevail. Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? Well, not God. Ezekiel 12 also. 12:24. This is one of the promises for the kingdom. There will no longer be any false vision or flattering divination within the house of Israel. For I, the Lord, will speak, and whatever word I speak, it will be performed. Flattering speech is also a favorite tactic of those who seek to advance false doctrine, those that are divisive, and those that seek to undermine the principles of sound doctrine coming from the pulpit. We just read those, Romans 16, verses 17 and 18. Keep your eye out for these types of people. F, it is clear that the flatterer does not concern himself with the welfare of the one he is flattering. In fact, he is literally setting a trap for him. Psalm 55. This one I am pretty sure is David's. Here, verse 21. His speech was smoother than butter, but his heart was war. His words were softer than oil, and yet they were drawn swords. This is the type of person we're talking about. Proverbs 29, next book over there, 29:5. A man who flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his steps. He's flattering him for a reason. We just don't know what the agenda is, but there's an agenda. Thus, G, like all forms of deceptive speech or lying speech, which always stem from some sinful mental attitude, lying and flattery lead to the ruin of those practicing it and those afflicted by it. So, again, this is just a fair enough warning. Be on your guard when people come to you and you're just great and never do any wrong. And this was the approach Mark Griffin always used with people. He would come to you and flatter you and tell you how great you were. And I've been around people like this before. And you want to be keenly aware of them as much as you can. Proverbs 26, 28. A lying tongue hates those it crushes. And a flattering mouth works ruin. And the way he would approach people when he had, and he had an agenda, he always had an agenda, I just didn't know it at the time. He was one of the few people that got away with it, that blindsided me, and I didn't see it coming. But I figured it out finally. You can't fool people forever. Your bad attitudes, your motives are going to come to the surface. And so when I began to ask him very direct questions, I couldn't get direct answers. I knew I was dealing with a liar, somebody who's got an agenda. But he would come at you with things like, well, I know you're oriented. You betcha. That's right. I know you're a mature believer. Yeah, yeah, keep talking. I know you're completely squared away. So, you know, what do you think about such and such? I'm not trying to draw you out, but prefacing it with flattery to get you to let down your guard and not pay attention. So in that regard, flattery is the modus operandi. That is the method by which a person operates or functions. Flattery is a deal of the evil woman. Proverbs 2. And of course, men are S-T-U-P-I-D. I don't want to offend anybody, so I won't say stupid. But they are. And part of sound teaching for the young man is to recognize that there are women that are dangerous. They're just flat dangerous. They will destroy men. And I don't think it's in this particular passage, but there's a passage. Maybe it's in the one coming up, so we'll look. Here, what does wisdom do? Wisdom delivers you from evil. It delivers you from criminal types. It also delivers the young man from the strange woman, from the adulteress who flatters with her words, that leaves the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. And so we've told believers, first, number one, if you're looking to have a relationship, you never engage in any kind of relationship with the opposite sex unless they're believers. That's the bare minimum starting point. If they're not believers, let's say they're a witch or something. You don't socialize with these people. Let's say they're a communist. Let's say they're advocating overthrow of the government. You can pick all kinds of things that women can be into. And you better stay away from it. It's all kinds of problems. But the bare minimum is they have to be a believer. And you really want a positive believer because you're going to end up with a divided household otherwise. And a divided household is troublesome. And you can ask anybody that endures it. That's in a marriage where they have a mixed marriage, one positive and one not. Oh, they're believers, okay. But they withstand God's plan by their behavior. They're absolutely antagonistic to sound doctrine. So if you want to date a girl, you bring her to Bible class first. You don't ever go out with anybody before you bring them to class. If they're not interested in the truth, then you need to cut them off right then and stop before you get emotionally involved with them. And this is all easily said until you reach puberty. And then it's not so easily done. I'm in love. And she pays attention to me. And in some cases, I've watched believers settle for somebody that they never should have married because they paid attention to them. They never should have married the person. And they're still suffering under this idea. And again, even in a household where you've got two believers, if they're on doctrinally different pages, it's not a pleasant experience. It's not a pleasant existence. You want peace in your household, and you will not have peace unless you have theological peace first. That's where peace begins, is orientation to God. And if the person's not oriented to God, you don't want them. Now, no matter how great they sound. Also, chapter 5. Chapter 7. I'm sorry. Chapter 7, verse 5. Say to wisdom in verse 4, you are my sister. And call understanding your intimate friend so they may keep you from an adulteress, from the foreigner who flatters with her word. And I looked at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive, and I discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense. You couldn't throw a rock at a group of young men and miss them. Every one of them's lacking sense, pretty much. That's the nature of being a youth. The exuberance of youth. I remember all this. When I was youth, I had the world by the tail, and I was going to conquer, and I was going to do everything I wanted. And nobody was going to stop me. I had my plan laid out. And God just got in the middle of it and said, no, 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 no. And then shredded my plan for me. And said, I have a different plan for you. And so young men are noticed. This is the defining characteristic of many young men. Naivete. They lack discernment because they don't have enough experience in this world. Sometimes you go through a situation, and once it happens to you once, you're keen to it from then on out. You don't get taken in by it again. She calls him calls out to him, and she seizes him in verse 13 and kisses him. And then she talks about her religious life, of all things. She's an adulteress, for God's sake. I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I've been to church. So we're good to go. Therefore, I've come out to meet you. Because you are special. You are different. You're the best man I've ever seen. The other guys aren't like you. Or as Michael Jackson said, I'm not like the other guys. He wasn't. To seek your presence earnestly. I have found you. And then verse 21, with her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. And suddenly he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, as one in fetters goes to the discipline of a fool. And I can't remember where that, it's in another place, but it says, on account of an adulterous woman, a man is reduced to a loaf of bread. Now, I don't know what you take away from that metaphor, that analogy. But the fact is, it's not a good one. I wanted to see it again, watching Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy the other day. And they go through, they don't have to muck about in hyperspace. They got the improbability drive. And you never knew how you were going to come out, though. But, and in one situation, they came out, they were chairs. There were two chairs sitting there. Well, can you imagine you come out of this deal with the adulterous woman and you're just a loaf of bread? That's all you got going for you. That's not good. The metaphor isn't good. So in that regard, this is her operandi. So it is not an activity the adjusted believer desires or one in which he engages. And if you do engage in it, when we fail, you rebound it. You deal with it. You recognize it's a sin. Since he recognizes that God does not favor those who do such things. The book of Job, 32. Verses 21 and 22. And I believe this is the youngest guy speaking here now. Elihu. And apparently, pretty much, he's right on. Job's friends quit trying to argue with him because it says at the beginning of the chapter, well, he was right in his own eyes. So they felt, I guess, we're not getting anywhere. Job claims he hasn't done some sin. Now, we know he has. We know God wouldn't do this otherwise. They were every bit as wrong about God doing it as Job was. But fortunately, we have the scenes opened up from behind with the curtain pulled back, and we see Satan's the one behind all this. So let me now be partial to no one, nor flatter any man. For I do not know how to flatter, else my Maker would soon take me away. The implication being God hates this and he'll get rid of it. And so while normal people tend to avoid difficult situations that involve confrontation, I've met some believers that will not address issues and confront things face to face. They're cowards. They only want to do it over the phone or text. Not even the phone, text and email. They want it to be as impersonal as possible because they don't want to have to come to grips with what you're going to say to them. Spiritual cowards that run from their failures and say, oh, well, it's everybody else's fault. And yet won't address it. So the believer who will faithfully and lovingly provide correction when it is needed is of far more value than those that only tell the believer the pleasant things that he wants to hear. And that's how some people get along. They just avoid difficult subjects. They avoid confrontation. They avoid... And none of us... I don't think normal people are in favor of it. I don't like confrontation. I don't like having to tell people, hey, this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing this. You should be able to live your own Christian life, is my thinking. I mean, the teaching from the pulpit should be sufficient to equip you. He who rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. And 27:6, previous chapter there. This is one of my favorite ones. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Really, I think the word is bruises. These aren't just, he didn't just slap you or something. This is a bruise, a painful wound. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And again, when people have nothing but good to say about you and that you're perfect and you're wonderful and all of that, watch out. They've probably got an agenda. So God is completely opposed to any type of verbal sin that conflicts with that which is true or honest. The adjusted believer prays that God will judge those who practice such things. This is again part of the imprecatory prayer for God's justice to be done. Some people struggle with the imprecatory prayer, but two things I can tell you about it. Number one, the psalmist is always addressing matters of moral right and wrong. He's not just praying against people for the hell of it. He's addressing matters that are completely bogus in many cases. And secondarily, he doesn't ever attempt to resolve it himself. He leaves it with the Lord. You do this. He leaves room for the wrath of God. He doesn't take his own revenge. 12, 3, and 4. Now, we've read this one. They speak falsehood to one another, flattering lips and a double heart. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips. But those people who have talk a good fight, they think they're going to prevail with their tongue. They think their tongue's going to win the day, not actions. Well, James takes that to task big time. Well, while unscrupulous men will resort to this tactic regularly to advance themselves at the expense of others, it is not a function of the adjusted communicator. Paul talks about this and the fact that he did not resort to this type of thing, and neither do we. There's a legitimate place for complimenting people, for offering praise to people when they're doing well. When you're consistent and faithful in Bible class, it is an encouragement to me. It is when you have your priorities straight and you're applying. Yes, this is encouraging. And it's not lost. I may not stop you or call you every day and tell you, hey, I appreciate what you do. I appreciate the prayers. I appreciate your application. But I do. I'm quite appreciative of what we have. And apart from what we have, I don't know what we would do, because there ain't very many of us left that really that are positive, frankly. And the numbers are dwindling. The light is going out on this planet. And so I only hope that the bear is ready to eat, and that this is just the beginning of the feast. And he's already rattling the sabers, as we know, about nuclear and biological warfare. And if the U.S. is destroyed in about the third year of Daniel's 70th week, it wouldn't bother me at all if the Feast of the Trumpets this year was bye-bye birdie, or bye-bye believers, you know. And I like that at the beginning, and I kind of thought it was funny, because Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is very anti-Christian, in case you don't know. It's got funny stuff in it, but boy, it's really anti-God. You know, they write these books, God's Big Mistakes, things God should have done differently. And they make fun of this. And it's very anti-Christian, but I liked at the beginning of it that they showed the dolphin rapture. They were a little bit ahead of the game. And in my thinking, the dolphins represent the believers. They're going to be leaving the planet first. 1 Thessalonians 2:5, he says, we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor did we come with a covering for our greed. We weren't greedy secretly and trying to make money off of you. God is witness. We didn't seek glory from men. We didn't try to get you to praise us either from you or others. Even though as apostles of Christ, we might have asserted our authority. And Paul's keenly aware of his authority. He just was very careful about how he exercised it. But again, if you're putting the lives of believers first, you're seeking to serve them, teach doctrine at the highest level you can. Authority isn't so much of an issue when people are oriented to that. It's not like I feel like I got to do a lot of shepherding with most of you, because you're pretty oriented. Here I am flattering you. So watch out. I'm going to come this afternoon and try to borrow some money. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to. So, but the adjusted communicator doesn't really. We don't flatter people to get them to like us, to get them to accept, to fly false colors in order to, quote, get our message across. You know. Like the Gary Hortons of this world. Faking lies, flattering people to get into places, venues he could not get into otherwise. Duplicitous. We don't want to engage in that type of activity. We want to be straightforward. So boasting is our next one here, Roman numeral 5, Hebrew vocabulary. There's only one Hebrew term that appears to focus on the matter of engaging in speech that is boastful. The noun afak is only used four times. 1 Samuel 2:3. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge. And the word actually is translated, it's not the word boast in that passage, it's the word arrogance. But that's what boasting is, it's arrogant speech. And it defines it as arrogance coming out of your mouth. And you can see these other Psalm 31:18. Well, we might look at that one. Psalm 31:18. These are all the same word. I just can't remember if they translated it the same way in every one, which would be nice. Let lying lips be mute. If they could only stop talking. Which speak arrogantly against the righteous. And that word there is arrogantly. It's the speaking arrogantly is what boasting is. And so you can see Psalm 75:5 and 94:4. Some verbs are used for boasting that do not have that root meaning. Rather, boasting is a derived meaning from a particular nuance of that verb in a particular context. The verb pa'er means to glorify, beautify, or adorn something. And in some contexts, it has the idea of boasting or bragging. Judges chapter 7. Verse 2. This is in the life of Gideon here. The Lord said to Gideon, he was a judge in Israel during that period. The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. For Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. And also Isaiah 10:15. Is the axe to boast over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. And so here, again, the idea of pa'er comes to high, is translated by the idea of boast or boasting. So the verb halel normally means to praise, extol, or eulogize. Matter of fact, our word hallelujah comes from this. That's the root of it. However, in certain places, it is referring to the verbal sin of bragging. For instance, 1 Kings 20, 11. And this is good advice for soldiers. And the king of Israel replied, let not him who girds on his armor boast like him who takes it off. The place for bragging and all of that, this is very misguided. Until the battle's over, you better not boast about your victory. You haven't even put on the armor yet, and you're acting like you've won the fight. That's stupid. Now, if you've won the fight and you're taking it off, that's a different ballgame. Well, in some cases, common terms or idioms are used to denote boasting. They must be defined in the context in which one finds them. The idiom secretly blessing himself refers to the mental attitude that prompts one to utter a boast. Deuteronomy 29. But again, this gets to the fact that these verbal sins very often, most often, maybe all the time, have a home in the middle attitude first. That's where it finds its root. It shall be that when he hears the words of this curse, that he will boast, saying, I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. There are a lot of believers out there like that. They walk in the stubbornness of their heart, but they think they have peace with God. Well, God's not impressed, and he's also not fooled. And so the idea that he will boast, i.e. secretly blessing himself, that he thinks he's above all of it. Well, sometimes the simple noun pet, mouth, is used to express the idea of verbally exalting oneself. Judges chapter 9, 38. And Zebal said to him, and literally what he says is, where is your mouth? now with which you have said. And they translate this interpretively that he's boasting. Where is your mouth with which you have said, who is Abimelech, that we should serve him? Is this not the people whom you despise? Go out and fight with them. The Greek vocabulary here, we got kaukaomai, a verb, 37 times. It's used legitimately of taking pride in something as one should. For instance, if you go out and work hard at the end of the day, you should take pride in a job well done. That's not boasting. That's legitimate recognition that God has provided and that you have applied. Or it can be used in a bad sense, to boast, glory, or brag about something. Kalkema, the related noun, 11 times. The act of taking pride in something. An expression of pride, a boast. It can also refer to what is said when one is boasting. So it can refer to the reason for it or the actual doing of it. And kalkasis, 11 times also, can refer to the action of boasting or to that which is the source, object of reason for boasting. I thought, as I looked at these words, that they are often used. Each probably has their own distinction, but they seem to be used interchangeably. That they're similar enough. Normally that ma suffix is passive. And it would have to do normally with the reason behind something. And kalkasis appears to be more active. But both of them are used of both the action and or the reason why you're boasting. What backs it up? Alizaniah. A noun, 2 times, mental attitude, pretension, or arrogance that expresses itself by presumption in word or deed. Alizon, a noun, 2 times, one who arrogantly presumes too much about himself and expresses it verbally, a braggart. Boasting is the verbal sin that involves using the tongue to express a high opinion of one's heritage, his abilities, accomplishments, possessions, or something that pertains to himself. It normally involves excessive pride in the mental attitude and is often accompanied by some degree of self-satisfaction. Those who are boasting are satisfied with themselves. They're happy to let you know it. And the fact is, as an adjusting believer, I mean, I don't get up every day and just think, well, I'm really satisfied with myself. I've done everything right. This is just another day, and I'm sure I'll do right all day long today, too. That's a presumption that I don't make. Now, and no matter what you've done, the reality is yesterday's gone. Those applications don't matter today. I'm glad you made them. God's happy we made them, but the fact is time moves on, and you have to move on with it. There are some people who look back and say, well, I used to apply at a very high level. Key word, they're used to. Or 2 key words. I used to apply at a high level. I've done my time. I've run into that attitude among believers. That they've suffered enough. They've done their time. They've fulfilled God's plan. And they don't intend to do much more. And that is a death sentence right there. Because if you're not going to continue moving forward with us, you're going to move backwards away from us. We have to keep moving in the angelic conflict. Or if you think you're standing still, you're not. You're going backwards. And when you see people who've abandoned the truth, abandoned sound teaching, and you see this 6 months later, you can't believe how bad they've gotten a year later, 2 years later. You can't believe the stupidity coming out of their mouths. And when I tell you that insanity isn't that far outside that door, I'm being deadly serious. It is not. It's not far out there for people who walk away from the truth. But there, something's got to take the place. Nature generally does not allow a vacuum. And so God, as he said, you got two things you need to keep track of as a believer. Take care of what you listen to. That is the content. Do you trust the person? Are they teaching the Bible? The principles of sound doctrine. And be careful how you listen. How much you're bringing to the game today, even. How much you're concentrating. How much you focus. How often, instead of doing something else, you review this, these doctrines occasionally in your spare time. Well, see, like all verbal sins, it exists first in the mental attitude. The most frequent mental attitude sin associated with boasting is arrogance. 1 Samuel 2:3. And that would be to be expected, I would think. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let arrogance come out of your mouth. And we've all done this. We've all, you know, been arrogant at times. You have to acknowledge it. We're not proud of it. We don't, you know, think it's a good thing. We deal with it. I presumed. But God is a God of knowledge. And with him, actions are weighed. It's not just your words. And again, I've watched believers who talk a good fight. But when push comes to shove, you can't count on them. And that's what you have to have, is faithfulness. Also, Psalm 75, 4 and 5. I said to the boastful, do not boast. And to the wicked, do not lift up the horn. To lift up the horn is an expression of exalting yourself, the idea of moving to a higher place. Do not lift up your horn on high. Do not speak with insolent pride. For not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation. But God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another. And we have to recognize that and trust that he knows what he's doing. Isaiah 16:6. And you see some of the things associated here, the negative things associated in this. We have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride, even of his arrogance, pride, and fury. His idle boasts are false. So then again, they may make boast all they want, but is there any truth to it? Is there any substance to it? He says, no, there's not in this case. But you got arrogance and fury. An anger word. And then lying, falsehood is mentioned there. James 4:16. This is in the context of people. Come now, in verse 13 begins his argument. You who say... So James here, because he's saying, you who say, he's not talking about some external enemy. He's talking about people he knows there that have this attitude, that fall into this category. Today or tomorrow, we go to such and such city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while, then vanishes away. Keeping yourself in perspective, this helps with the whole pride thing. We've got 70 years, give or minus, a plus or minus on this planet. You know, may get 80, 85, some of them get 90, some of them get 100. But the reality is, how many applications are you going to be making at 90 and 100 years old? Probably not too many. Although I do know one particularly, for those of you who know Marie Tuck, I don't know how old she is, but she's still hanging in there. And attending Bible class, and Janelle Accord right up until her death. faithful in class. So if you don't worry about tomorrow, but you recognize, hey, well, that's a big thing. You live on a planet with 7 billion people. How important are you really? I mean, in the big scheme of things, we're just another brick in the wall, so to speak. And so we don't really have any room for arrogance because, one, we're so temporal. Our lives are temporal. They're here, they're gone. And all the people, you know, now we're getting to the age where all my heroes are dying. All the people I looked up to, I don't really have heroes. But people I looked up to or admired or thought they were funny, they're dying. The generation's passing away. They were here for a while. And that's all we'll be. Instead, you ought to say this. If the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. And all such boasting is evil. So therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and doesn't do it, to him it is sin. So if you know this business of planning in your arrogance about the future and you're going to do it and you don't need God in it, well, number one, he's aware of that. And that's sinful, whether you accept it, it's sinful or not. People that are making their lives about money, whether it's about money for now, their vacations, their retirement, I don't care what it is. And we're not against planning ahead. We're not against being good stewards. If I've harped on anything over the last 30 plus years, it's been that, of how to properly orient to money, because most of our society, most of our culture is maladjusted to money. They don't deal with it from a Christian perspective. And so, to make these boasts, this is actually sin. If you know not to do it, and then you go ahead and do it. Well, and you can also see 1 John 2:16. D, it is an ingrained part of the sin nature and the cosmic system. It is a characteristic of the reprobate mind, and is frequently practiced by those that do not fear God. Romans 1, this is at the end of Paul's indictment of the entire Gentile world cultures and their views and how they live. And basically, there's a trade-off the unbeliever makes, the negative unbeliever specifically. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, this is the problem with our world. They don't acknowledge God, and they certainly don't acknowledge his rights in all of this. They don't acknowledge him, even when they might know he exists. They don't honor him. They don't treat him as God. That was a beginning of the indictment back in 1:18. Even though they knew there was a God, or it might be 19. Verse 21, actually. For even though they recognized God, in other words, they knew he existed. They know there's a God. The law of cause and effect tells you that there has to be an original cause. The basic logic, the laws of thermodynamics would suggest that everything is at one time perfectly organized, that it falls into a state of greater disorganization and decay over time. And there are a number of ways one can come to the knowledge of the fact that God exists, cause and effect, physical laws that one can observe, laws of mathematics, 0 + 0 never equals 1. You have to have a pre-existent something. But just because humans can't understand God and his infinite wisdom, they just say, well, he doesn't exist. I don't want to have to deal with that idea. The goal is to live in this world and have a good life, and that's all I'm looking for. And if that's all they're looking for, that's all they'll get. Maybe, even if they get that. May not necessarily get the good life they want. But they recognized him as God, but they didn't honor him as God. And finally, after a point, God gives them over. 3 times or 4, he uses this phrase. God gave them over. This is God abandoning people to their lesser nature, to their lower nature, and letting them just run rampant with it. And he hands them over. This is a judicial judgment, and they will keep running away from God. And that judgment will only get worse, because they're going to continue to antagonize God with their unrighteousness and their lifestyles. So God gave them over. In verse 26, to degrading passions. You see the homosexual menace, and it is that, a menace. But we treat it in America as if it's a blessing and we should all embrace it. Just like we do, we embrace the military and all that, so we should embrace this. It's a menace, according to the scriptures. But people don't want to deal with the scriptures. They don't want to stand up for God's rights in these matters. And so he gave them over. And then God gave them over, verse 28, to a depraved mind, to do those things that are not proper. And so that's where it starts. And now look what we've got: unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy. See, the picture Paul paints of the secular world is never a good one. And of course, the Jew would have been standing there jumping up and down. That's right, Paul. Those Gentiles are horrible. Those godless heathen, they are just God-awful. And then Paul turns around and says, hey, how about you? You condemn these people, but don't you do the same things? And if you practice the same things, do you really honestly believe that God's going to look the other way because you were circumcised? And of course, that's the Jewish boast. I'm a seed of Abraham. I'm circumcised. I've got a relationship with God. I'm a part of Israel. I'm a part of the covenant. And guess what? They're not. Because that never was the issue. So it's frequently practiced again by those who do not fear God. It is a major characteristic of those living in the last days. We are warned about this, and so we would expect things to continue to deteriorate. 2 Timothy 3:2. And we see it deteriorating. This is the nature of the world. Men will be lovers of self in the last days. Perilous is this word, dangerous, difficult, deadly. Times will come. We're living in the most evil time since the flood. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy. All right, well, there's the noise, so we'll stop today. Let's go ahead and pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that this information would find a home. We would consider these matters and watch our speech for your glory. In Christ's name, amen.